Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
The Fed cuts rates again. Manufacturing slumps and it's firmly in correction. But the employment report soothes recession fears. New highs for markets. But not all stocks are participating. All this and much more on episode number 635 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Hey, hello there. It's Andrew Horowitz and welcome. Welcome to November 2019, which is, of course, seasonally the best couple of months ahead for markets. At least that's what they say. You know, this is when those horses are kind of approaching the barn, and the end of the year is in sight, and managers are doing what they can to make sure that portfolios are looking pretty good. A little bit of rotation that goes on. Well, we have a quick note before we begin the show here. And first of all, I very much appreciate all your emails and comments. Of course, you could ask me any questions that you'd like over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Just go over to the Ask Andrew section and just click that button and send me your comment, your question, whatever it is. I'll be happy to answer it and maybe even answer it on the show. We have a couple questions in today that we will make part of today's episode. So stick around for that as we have a couple I think are pretty interesting. I also want to make sure that all of you have checked out the strategies that we manage for clients. A lot of times people say, hey, you know what? You didn't mention where to go. Just go to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Maybe you want to become a client of ours. And basically it all starts with, you know, understanding what we do, how we do it. And all that can be found at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Strategies like Investology, our global allocations, our long, short strategy, the TDI managed growth strategy, and that helps with style diversification for your portfolios. And before we get into the meat of today's discussion, I thought I'd just kind of share with you some of the things that I did over the past week or so. Last weekend, I was over in Washington, D.C. I had this great opportunity to participate in a charity golf tournament up there. Spectacular. I mean, man, I live down here in Florida. It's hot all the time. So getting out to somewhere where I can play golf at 65 degrees. The trees are all turning colors for the, you know, approach of the winter season. And it was perfect. The only problem was that there was all these leaves on the golf course. So anytime you hit a ball that was not exactly on the fairway, it was halfway to impossible to find the ball. I mean, I think that we played a scramble. There was four of us watching the ball the whole time. I think I lost about 10 balls. And I'm not talking about out of bounds, off to the in a creek somewhere, you know, buried in a sand trap. No, I'm talking about just, we saw it land. There it is. We're going to get it. And it's nowhere to be found. It's kind of like eaten by the leaves. But it was great. Went to a great vineyard. There's a lot of vineyards in Virginia. I didn't know about that. And had the opportunity to spend some time in Chinatown. Not the best Chinatown in the world. A couple of restaurants. But I look back and yes, I am glad I live in Florida. Because even though it looks beautiful right now up in the Northeast, it's going to get cold. I mean, you know how it is. So it gets hot down here, but nonetheless, I kind of had that real refreshing moment of spending time with the leaves changing colors. This weekend was the boat show down here in South Florida. As a matter of fact, I went to I've been to the boat show every year for the past 10 years or so. This year, I was only able to go for a little while. I was able to go probably for a total of, I would say, about an hour. I had a breakfast meeting at the boat show, and then I was able to go. My son Brett is selling these mega yachts. So I went on these 100 to 150-foot, just gorgeous vessels. There was one boat, yacht, vessel that I was on. It was about 120 feet. As soon as you got on and you walked into the salon from the outside into the inside, I was like, what is going on here? Because there was a full-on casino. There was, to my left, a craps table. Right behind that was a roulette table. There was a blackjack table. And at the end was a stripper pole right in the middle of the room. So obviously somebody was having a little fun on their boat. Other than that, the other thing I saw that was really cool was on the back of this one boat, mounted on a hydraulic swim platform, there was a 4x4, you know, a four-wheeler. What was really cool about this particular four-wheeler was it's called a quad ski. Because as soon as the hydraulics drop it into the water, the wheels flip up, and now it's an absolute 100% jet ski. So it could be used on land. It could be used on the water. Really a really cool thing. The other thing that I thought was really interesting was these big booming cranes that I saw. And these cranes on the back of the boats help launch boats and recreational vehicles and all sorts of things. But what was on this one boat that I saw was a personal submarine. And it's capable of reaching feats of about, I guess, about 100 feet or 150 feet, maybe even more underwater, fully pressurized. It's kind of a glass globe. So you had a 360-degree vision and view of everything in the water. Of course, there were some of those yachts that had helicopters, but that's kind of old. We've seen that before. Seeing a really cool submarine and these quad skis were awesome. You're probably saying, well, what does that cost? Because I asked that question. What does it cost? I mean, what are we talking about here in terms of some of these boats? Anywhere from the boats that I was on, anywhere from $10 million to $200 million. And I think probably the other cool thing that was there was each boat I got on, I went up to the bridge to see what was going on. Wow, the technology that's going on. Some of these didn't have steering wheels. There's no steering wheel in the boat. You have basically just joysticks and computers running the whole thing. And across the front where the captain would stand, 4 to 5 widescreen monitors that are mounted with all the instrumentation, all of it has been, in digital format is the best way to describe it. So whether it's your compass, your fuel tanks, your heading, your GPS, your radar, cameras that are showing you all parts of the boat, particularly useful when you're docking and at sea. And yeah, people are buying these. It's not like these things are just on show for no reason. People are buying these boats and pretty active. Interestingly, there is an estimate that about $850 million worth of services, goods, and total revenue come into Fort Lauderdale for the boat show each and every year. It's like having a spectacular Super Bowl in Fort Lauderdale. That's how much revenue this brings in each and every year from the boat show. So if you haven't had the opportunity to attend the Fort Lauderdale Boat Show, this is not a pitch per se. I'm just telling you personally, I think that you would be well served to do that. And why not? I mean, why wouldn't you come down? And this is why other people are coming down to see just the incredible amount of money that's being spent right now. I mean, money's cheap, right? There's plenty of liquidity out there. Central banks are doing everything they can to pump in stimulus. That money flows well to risk assets and obviously to these mega yachts. And on that note,
1/4 point cut, the Federal Reserve cutting interest rates by 1/4 point to a new range of 1.5% to 1.75% for the third rate cut this year. The Fed removing the phrase that it will, quote, act as appropriate.
This is what seemed to be one of the most important things right there. I want to stop it there for a second. That they removed the phrase of acting as appropriate and then put in the next phrase.
The Fed removing the phrase that it will, quote, act as appropriate. Instead, the committee now says it will, quote, assess the appropriate path of the Fed funds rate. Two dissents. One, Rosengren and George, who wanted to hold rates steady. Bullard, who was a dissenter at the last meeting, who wanted a 50 basis point cut, now is voting with the majority. Fed says it will cut, today's cuts were motivated by, quote, global developments and muted inflationary pressures.
So here we are back to the same thing again, where we have supposedly no inflation going on. It has nothing really to do with our economy here in the United States, but more so it has to do with the fact that the rest of the world is having trouble. And moreover, the rest of the world is a subtext here for central banks around the world dropping rates and therefore making our debt stand out that much more and making us less competitive, therefore reducing rates to keep pace with what the global central banks are actually doing.
Cuts were motivated by, quote, global developments and muted inflationary pressures. The assessment of the economy, essentially the same as it had been in the past. Said the labor market remains strong. Economic activity is rising at a moderate rate. These are all the same phrases it used in the prior statement in September.
So essentially, there's been no significant change to the economy. It still remains in a moderate growth trajectory. Employment is at a 50-year low. Inflation, okay, not so much inflation, but generally speaking, everything is in pretty good shape, but they're cutting anyway, three times. The major issue, again, the takeaway from this whole report and the whole commentary and then the follow-up press conference was that the Fed looks like they're going to be on hold for a little while. Markets didn't exactly know what to do with that, but it does look like they're going to be on hold at least through the end of the year.
In September, job gains, it says, were solid on average in recent months. Unemployment rate has remained low. Household spending rising at a strong pace. Business investment and exports both have weakened, the Fed.
So there you have it. The Fed lowers its benchmark rate by 25 basis points to the range of 1.5 to 1.75. That was kind of expected. They indicated they may pause rate cuts from here, at least until there's some other data and evidence that the economy is slowing. And it did that by removing an important clause that appeared to be changing from acting as appropriate or saying his commitment to act as appropriate to sustain the expansion. So a lot of things to read into, but essentially aside from that, no changes in the statement. There was very little that really changed. Markets did well. They liked it. They saw, hey, another rate cut. That's good. I like it. Why not? Easy money, low cost. Now, the next day, there was some concern. It looked like over the idea that this may be the last rate cut for a while. Markets initially on the announcement kind of moved around a little bit, but then took off solidly into the upside on the rate cut announcement. The next day, there was a couple of things that collided. I think the first thing was the realization that, the Fed is there, but they're not really there unless something changes dramatically. In other words, if we have another month or 2 months or even 3 months that they see the continuation of moderate growth and employment staying pretty strong, and household savings and spending, all this stuff doing well, they're not going to make much of a change. Now, another reason that the markets did, in fact, start to get a little bit sloppy on Thursday was that we had this weird news from China that they don't believe that they're going to have the ability to do a long-term trade deal because maybe there's some sticking points on some of the items that they're looking at. Possibly there's going to be some concern about the idea that they don't know if they could trust us to make sure that they are abiding by rules that are set forth that we may not, the U.S., we being the U.S., that may not be able to stick by. But then, of course, we saw just right after that, the trade talks are going really well. So, back to this whole idea of the news, you can't really pay attention to the news prints from either side at this point. Now, let's skip forward to one more day, Friday, kind of interesting day. Because last month, there was a lot of concern about the ISM manufacturing and services report that came out. If you remember, we saw that the ISM manufacturing was very significantly lowered. And the number came in very concerning that manufacturing had slowed down to a dramatic pace that confirmed that the manufacturing sector is in a recession. And that was pretty worrisome, but not that bad because everybody was looking at, okay, well, what's going on with services? Services came out last month and it was a little bit worse than anticipated. Markets sold off pretty hard on that. But again, we didn't see a dip into the contraction zone for services. So on Friday, when both the employment report came out and the ISM manufacturing ticked up a little bit as compared to last month. However, it was still pretty low, still in contraction, still showing us that there is essentially a recession going on in the manufacturing area. And a lot of that has to do with the trade war and how it continues to hit several areas of the economy and very specific areas of the economy, in particular, manufacturing. Now, the good news on Friday was that, you know, we saw the jobs number. And the jobs number came in at 128,000 additional added to the payrolls, and that was good. It was up from the expectation, or beat the expectation by about 50,000. Expectations were about 75,000. When you brought in the idea that there was a major amount of numbers of people in the strikes in the automobile area that were going to actually come off of the payrolls. So we saw this number, and, you know, even though it was very weak from the aspect of where there was a, you know, the strike was concerned, but the rest of the numbers look really strong. And, I mean, services were really strong. So that is laying out the idea that the potential ISM services, which we'll see next week, won't be as bad as expected. There was more. In fact, we saw there was revisions to last month's numbers, and there was, for the last 2 months, there was a significant increase in hiring. So that was good. So the employment picture is pretty rosy, no question about that. And this is, I think, bringing on the idea that employers are viewing this situation as good, their own personal or their own company's situation is good, and they're willing to actually go out and add more people to the payroll, not concerned about the future being problematic. And that is pretty good when it comes to markets, because this is why there is such a high level of interest in the jobs numbers, because they are pretty good at telling us how employers are thinking, and really that backs into how companies are doing. If they think that there's going to be a real slowdown in their sector, they're probably not going to be adding a lot of employees. But if they believe that, you know what, they need to fill positions because there's more demand, or at least the same demand that has been for some time, they're going to continue adding employees. And as we've discussed before, this is good for markets and it's good for the economy because it adds a level of confidence. And high confidence in the labor markets, what do? They trickle down to spending, and they move down to confidence overall, and they help savings, which is what the Fed has been saying, that there is moderate growth out there. And at the same time, we're seeing that, you know, consumers are spending. They are doing a good job at holding up the economy. So we'll see if that last monthly number on the ISM services survey that we saw last month, one that's coming out this week, the next month, is going to be that concerning, or if it was a one-month blip. So we're going to get the ISM services next month. Last month, it came in at 52.6, and this should be, I think, a pretty important one to watch next week. Factory orders we're going to see on Monday probably slowed further. Later in the week, we're going to get insights into productivity, consumer credit, consumer sentiment for November, and wholesale inventories. One of the other things we've noticed in the markets is that, I mean, you can't not notice this, tech. Tech has been on fire. I mean, really strong. Obviously, Apple powering up to all-time highs on a regular basis, select semiconductors keeping pace, and the whole mega cap tech rally has been really doing a good job at leading the markets, which is really good for index investors. But below the surface, there are a few cracks. Matter of fact, I'd go so far as saying this is a lot of train wrecks below the surface. But that doesn't necessarily look to be derailing a generally upward bias or upward slope for markets, right? We could all agree the fact that there's a lot of index and passive investing going on that is pulling up markets dramatically due to the fact that people are just putting money into play in the indices. And by doing so, they're pretty much buying all the stocks regardless of what it is. Even though underneath the surface, we're seeing the small caps are not keeping up. There's some other companies that are missing and getting obliterated. We saw a few of those last week. So even though we're seeing that the markets, when I say the markets, the indices, the S&P 500, the Dow Jones Industrials, the Russell 1000, the Russell 2000, the NASDAQ, these are all doing pretty well, generally speaking, right? As an index, they're doing well. All-time highs for most of them, not the Dow, but several other of the indices are at all-time highs on Friday after we saw those numbers, and there was that sigh of relief due to the, you know, woo, employment doesn't look so bad. But, you know, on a technical basis, I think we need to talk about this for a second. Because as we know, markets can remain overbought for some time. But yeah, there are some overbought signals that are actually occurring in the markets right now. And I think that's something that we really need to look at. And, you know, yeah, I mean, overbought, oversold, you know, what does that exactly mean? And what do we look at? You know, what particular indicators do we look at to understand if we are in a situation that is overbought or oversold? And again, I'm going to tell you something that generally speaking, when we see an overbought condition, when we look at there is a condition that is overbought, that could stay for a while. Oversold and deeply oversold often is bought up very quickly, regardless if we're in an uptrend or a downtrend. In an uptrend, overbought happens very quickly, stays there or can stay there, and it can stay overbought for a very long time. Oversold, snap of a finger, just gets bought up in an uptrend. In a downtrend, you don't see as much overbought going on unless you have a one-time move that's really sharp and all of a sudden it's a reversal off a low and then it starts to move down again, the trend continues. But oversold kind of resolves also. So generally speaking, oversold levels, deeply oversold levels, I always find to be much more of a buying situation than overbought being a selling situation. So what are we looking at though? Again, what areas do we want to look at? What technical indicators are important? Well, a lot of times you'll hear on TV, a lot of people talking about RSI, the Relative Strength Index, or the RSI. It's, you know, there's different ways to look at it. But basically, you look at an RSI and 70 plus 70 is an area of that most consider to be overbought. Down below 20 or 30 is oversold. And right now, the RSI for the S&P 500 is approaching 70, and for the NASDAQ, for that matter, the S&P and the NASDAQ. The S&P, on another level, is trading two standard deviations above its 50-day moving average line. And if you have the ability to put a daily time frame chart together with SPY or the S&P 500 index, put on a Bollinger Band, and instead of the traditional 20-day moving average with two standard deviations above and two standard deviations below, put the 50-day moving average. And you'll see something very interesting. Look for every time, or many times in the past year, 2 years, where the S&P 500 has approached its two standard deviations above its 50-day moving average, and then what happens? I mean, we're getting pretty up there. We're getting pretty lofty in that, if you want to consider that being an overbought. Clearly, as it moves beyond that, it becomes a crazy number. But that is somewhat of a ceiling that I've seen many times and many times play out that we need to watch for. So we have an RSI that's 68, 68 and a half. We have two standard deviations above the 50-day moving average, or the top line of the Bollinger Band for the 50-day moving average. Both are at the highest level since July. Now, our key reversal indicator that we have, that we look for peaks and troughs in the market, specifically dealing with the S&P 500 and broad-based measure, utilizing things like sentiment indices, that's only at a plus two. Not too hot. It's not too overbought at this point, but it is showing slightly concerning overbought conditions. Plus five, plus six, which you hardly ever get to. Those are levels that you really need to be aware of. Those are areas that are very concerning. So what does this all mean though, right? Does it mean we're in for an imminent crash or correction or drop in the markets? No, because again, I'm going to state this again for the record. Overbought conditions can last for a very long period of time unless they get too crazy overbought. They do resolve, and the question is, do they resolve because the indicators will catch up and it will smooth out over time? Or resolve that the price comes down to meet where normalization is, back down to the 50, let's say, on the moving average for the S&P 500 or the NASDAQ, or whatever particular indice you're looking at. But what this does tell us and what it does show us is there is a bit of heat in the market. You would have known that without me telling you that. I didn't have to sit here and tell you that today. You know that the markets are a little bit hot. And is it possible that they're getting so hot that they're headed for a burnout? A burnout either to an exhaustion peak on the top side, which we really haven't seen yet, but it's kind of looking a little bit, if you back away from your chart, it's looking like the slope has really dramatically changed for markets. And when we consider that earnings, even though 75% of companies are beating estimates, but they're going to come in on the S&P 500 down on a year-over-year basis, what is the rationale that people are going to have to pump money into a market with valuations, with the PE currently trading at 22.8 on a trailing basis, or 18 for quarter one 2020, and 16.8 for quarter four 2020? What is the impetus for people to keep on putting money, except for the fact that, well, money is cheap, the stimulus out there, there's nowhere else to put your money, and that the momentum is for an uptrend? Those are all good reasons. But when do valuations come into play? That's going to be the big question. And either we're going to see one of two things, which is always the case. Either valuations are going to start to get more normalized compared to where they are now, approaching longer-term historical levels, because either prices come down or earnings go up. Now, the forward PE is north of 18 for quarter one of 2020. So estimates are still pretty high for the longer term, stating that, you know what, there's really not going to be a concern about any of these tariffs, any of the trade wars, any of this stuff, and there's not going to be a slowdown in the economy. Companies are going to continue to be able to post year-over-year, quarter-over-quarter gains. But we see this all the time. Analysts are pretty excited about the future when the future is way out in the future. And as we get closer, as the future becomes less and less, you know, it's a quarter out instead of three quarters out, they have some adjustments they make on their estimates. So while estimates are still high for the long term, back to the second half and even the last quarter of 2020, what we're really seeing here right now in the markets and why prices are going up and what we have to observe is simply, it's what's called a multiple expansion. And we touched on this last week, that people are willing to pay more money for the same stock with no growth of earnings now, but with the thought that, you know what, it's going to grow into that multiple over time. So then I ask, well, by the way, you asked too, because I get the emails. And this is a question that comes along quite often. Are the markets too high? Should I invest right now? Yeah, that's a good question. But we have to consider, I think we have to let a couple things be known and put it into that discussion. Because what is a market that's too high? What is it based on? Because it's really price that's all that matters, right? I mean, in the end, valuations will matter. But it's only if valuations don't keep up or earnings don't keep up to make sure that those valuations can be realized. And when we consider that rates are super low, potentially moving lower, maybe not just here in the United States, but clearly around the world, we see that central banks are doing everything in their power to push stimulus, to bring down rates, to go even further negative. Maybe it's not too high. Maybe, you know, maybe it's about right. Because again, where are you going to put money to get real returns? And the hope is that the Fed and central banks around the world can essentially stay ahead of the curve, right? They're going to be able to stay ahead of this whole slowdown. Now, let's look at something for a second. Europe. Europe's falling apart. Europe is in disaster zone. Germany's economy looks awful. Europe in totality looks terrible. Their stocks are just moving up like, hey, you know what? Things are just fine. And a lot of that is due to the fact of the excess stimulus that's being pumped into the markets and finding its way into risk assets. And again, you ask, well, is that too high? Well, if we never get above these earnings levels that we have right now, and if it doesn't turn around and Europe somehow does not manage to get itself out of the potential for driving itself right into a recession, regardless of the fact that central bank stimulus has been out there and they have negative rates, well, no. It's not a good thing. And yes, that market is too high. But the bull take on all this is that this slowdown is transitory. And once the stimulus kicks in, earnings get back to growing, prices will normalize, and if PEs will just adjust. That's what everybody's looking for. Looking for, hey, you know what? I've done this before. I mean, we had a horrendous market correction back in X year. You know, pick whatever year you want to look at. From the 2000s to the 1990s, 1980s, 1970s. There was these terrible market corrections, but you know, if I just left my money in and didn't touch it, look where I'd be now. Or, man, I pulled my money out. I didn't get back in. I could have had so much more. I got spooked. I got scared. I got concerned. I felt that, you know, if I left my money in, it was going to go down to zero. And I think people, what they're doing right now is saying, you know what, I'm really not worried about that. I'll just index it. I'll just put it into a stock. I'm not going to sell it. But when it comes to the idea that Europe is going to be able to grow into its expanded multiples, it seems that there's just an enormous, this gigantic leap of, I guess, faith that all this is going to happen and work out well. I mean, it's not just there. It's everywhere around the world. We're seeing a slowdown in economies. And somehow there's been this separation of, hey, you know, it doesn't really matter what the economy does. It only matters what stocks do and what companies are able to earn. I dare say, though, that there is a correlation and a relationship when it comes to how good or bad an economy is doing and potentially how good or bad a stock and a company can do. There's only so much of a slowdown that a company can take on before their earnings starts to be affected. I don't think anybody, each company is different, of course, but I'm saying generally speaking, economic slowdowns make their way down into the corporate market, into the individual situation. But once again, we've talked about this. What's the most important thing right now? It's earnings that are doing well and employment. The employment number is really important because it allows for more money to flow in the market through 401ks. It allows for more people to have more money in their purse, pocketbook, wallet, pockets in order to spend. So all these things are really very, very helpful and very beneficial for markets. I don't think that we have any significant disagreement about that. And really, as long as the Fed keeps the punch bowl full, you know, I don't think anybody's going to have too much of a concern, because even in the face of record debt at the sovereign and corporate levels, so far nothing's really been a problem, right? We haven't seen anything from any major countries or companies have a major default or problem when it comes to payment of their debt, right? And even when there's been a flare-up, like we saw recently, by the way, in the repo market, well, just throw a lot of money at it and paper it over. And that seemed to take care of it. I mean, when you're talking about not just, he has $100. Let's see if it solves the problem. No, when we talk about $50 billion a month or $100 billion a month going into a particular sector of the market, that does a lot to soothe the pain that may be afflicting anything. I mean, thinking about this, if a company started having a lot of trouble and all of a sudden there was a bailout just instantaneously of $50 billion for the company, think how much they could do with that. So I believe that there's a lot of good thoughts with the idea that any problem that we're going to have can be solved by just simply taking a helicopter, dump truck, and just throwing money on it. But what I find really interesting is something that this conversation I've been having for some time now with many of my colleagues, and it revolves around, well, what are we going to do here? Because, well, markets are going up, and we see this going on. Investors are caught in this whole momentum and FOMO, and they want to be in there. We're finding it harder and harder to find stocks that we want to buy that show us a really good risk-reward setup, or maybe even a decent value proposition. This is a conversation that I've been hearing out there, that I've had conversations with various money managers and people in the profession, and it's pretty much consistent. And what's interesting is also in line with what we're finding here. I made a point over the last couple of weeks of discussing this, actually a couple of, I think going back a couple of months now, discussing this whole idea of, you know, we have the screening and filtering and quantitative process of finding stocks for the TDI managed growth strategy for the core element of that particular strategy. And over the last 4 months or 5 months, that screen, which oftentimes we have 50 or 60 names inside of there, maybe even as high as 70 when times are really good, is now in the 30s, 32, 33. So out of 5,000 stocks that we're looking at in the entire universe of equities, we're only finding 30 or 35 stocks that meet the criteria. And if you recall, I talked about this, right? We're looking for growth of earnings on a year-over-year basis, going back several years and several different quarterly comparisons. We're looking at growth of earnings, revenues. We're looking at expanding margins. We're looking for all the things that you want to find in a company that's doing really well. And somehow, we're not finding these growth characteristics. And I guess we'll call it solid fundamental underpinnings for a growth name. And I find that concerning. I find what the issue there is that I'm, when I look at that, I say, well, why is it? What is happening? And in fact, well, it's telling me that investors are willing to bid up growth names that have not been showing growth characteristics. It tells me that investors are less critical, and they're willing to buy stocks regardless of the fundamentals. It's telling me also that index and passive investing is responsible for raising all ships. Talked about that last week. It tells me that people are content to hold on through thick and thin, and that they're going to buy a stock, they're going to hold it regardless of what's going on. They're going to buy an index or an ETF or a passive, maybe even a mutual fund, and just hold on to it. It tells me that liquidity is driving up prices, absent pretty much any other rationale. And it's telling me that I think complacency is pretty high here. VIX now sub 13. And interestingly, a couple of years ago, we had a very similar circumstance as we have now. So what we did was we very gently, just slightly, just an ever such a small change to relax a couple of the criteria in the metrics that we look for in the quantitative screening process to ensure that we can have some decent names in there and kind of lower the bar a little bit. And for the record, we're not relaxing it any further. It's not a lot of relaxation compared to where it was, but there was a little bit of numbers that we said, you know what, we could have a little bit less growth right now because we think we're getting into another more mature market condition, and it's okay to have just slightly less characteristics that show significant growth, but not so much that we're going to be reckless. Listen, it's not a major change, but just a couple of tweaks. And with that, I think that while we're concerned on one hand about markets, and we know, of course, that trees don't grow to the sky, right? On the other hand, we must also respect the trend and what the market's telling us. So you're kind of caught in this dichotomy. You're caught up in a point where, well, should we just throw in and say, what the hell? You know, hey, stocks are going up. It doesn't matter anymore. Throw out the fundamental criteria. You know what happens when that comes about, right? If everybody starts doing that, what you have is a market not only is overbought, but you have a market that is treading on very thin ice, and people need to really check themselves before they wreck themselves if they go too far with that. Because you're going to be buying stocks at levels and prices that are ridiculous. Just look at what happened to companies like Pinterest this week. You know, look at Twitter. Look at some of the other names that really got hammered after earnings. Wayfair. Companies that shouldn't be at priced that they were. But it didn't matter because people were just willing to put in money and willing to invest and willing to say, you know what, it doesn't really matter. I'm in it for the long haul. Then you take a 25% whack on a stock that may take you 3, 4, 5 years maybe to get back to where it was. So are there really, I mean, you know, with that, are there any of these dire warning red flags that are out there that are really presenting themselves these days? Not really. There's a lot of caution signs. There's a few speed bumps. My best advice here, my thought on all of this, when it comes to valuations, investing just because prices are going up and that's it, is while you're in it, it feels right. But don't get complacent. Keep a sharp eye out on just things generally that don't look right and kind of put that in your bag, right? Write it down, put it to the side, start making a list. What is it that's going on right now that doesn't seem right? And then add all those up. Watch them. More importantly, understand that overconfidence often results in errors in judgment. I mean, even if we believe we're not overconfident, we can sometimes all get carried away. You believe that this stock is a winner, it's always going to be a winner, and it's going to continue just going up and marching higher forever? And you get complacent and overconfident. I think the quote from, I found a quote recently from Masayoshi Son, who is the CEO and one of the lead investor really for SoftBank. He says, my belief is that we should never become overconfident. Now, I got to tell you, when I read that, I was seriously laughing. Okay, I'm laughing right now. I'm thinking, wait a second. This is the guy, the same Masayoshi Son, the CEO of SoftBank, who poured billions of dollars into Uber and WeWork and now lost billions of dollars to date, and more importantly, continues to pump more money into this because he's confident and so confident on his WeWork that if he gets rid of the board, puts in a couple of different players, that this is going to turn out and magically he's going to take from a $5 to an $8 billion loss, make all that back up by pumping in another few billion dollars. So overconfidence can really happen to the best of us, right? So I'm going to say it again. Just simply follow the rule of check yourself before you wreck yourself. And now, a few listener questions. Let's get those out here. I have them in front of me. You can hear the paper rustling. Let's see what we got. Again, you can go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com, click on Ask Andrew, and just ask some questions. This one's from Kevin D. He says, hey, Andrew, over the last couple of years, we've been RV traveling around the country. Love it. When we pass through a town, we can usually tell if it is a dying town or a growing town by the nice buildings or empty decaying buildings. Recently, we traveled through Hot Springs, Arkansas, and other Arkansas towns. We noticed a lot of new bank buildings and big bank buildings. Do you have any thoughts on why banking in sections of the country seems to be building so much? I was thinking the government must be doing something like forcing them to retain capital, and the buildings could be a part of their capital. You know, I think what's happening is that we're finding that there's a lot of money in the system. Money is very cheap. While banks, and particularly the small SNLs, or if you want to call them the smaller community banks, are not making as much money, what a lot of them are doing, it seems, is building several branches and then merging with other banks and then being bought up by the big banks. It's kind of like they're laying the groundwork to be bought up by the bigger banks, because now the bigger banks have the customer base already there. It's proven. So instead of the big banks maybe opening up some of their branches in a small town in Arkansas, maybe they're saying to a couple of people, you know what, you open up a branch, you take the risk and see how it works. If it works out well, maybe we'll get a few of you together and then we'll buy all of you. Just an idea. Other than that, I have no idea. It is possible that there is the concept there'll be some growth. And you're only looking at a few places. I know you're traveling around in the RV, but you're only looking at a few places. Maybe that place finally has some businesses coming in. Maybe for many years it really was a smaller town with not a lot of work going on, and possibly the employment being where it is now, there's more of a need for a banking institution with a brick exterior, not just online. So maybe it's possible that they're building these because there is a boom happening. I don't know necessarily if there's any other reason like you're mentioning here. I just think that possibly it's a better time right now and an opportunity for some of these banks to really get going with the idea they'll be bought out one day. Let's see. This question comes from Craig P. He says, "Hey, Andrew and team, long-time listener, first-time emailer. I'm wondering about your thoughts on manufactured housing sector, specifically two stocks he mentioned." He says, "I really don't have a price target. I really just started investing in this sector at the end of 2017 and the idea that this area does well in early stages of a recession. Meanwhile, my position is up 80% even as the market has continued to rise. Maybe lots of other people have the same idea. I'm unsure of when to exit my original thesis. My original thesis was that if the area should heat up even more as the first pain points of a recession start to hit and people move down the housing scale. I took some off the table, but wanted to see if any thoughts on that." All right, so we don't give away any, we can't provide any individual stock advice. And that's why I didn't read the symbols that you gave me here. But I will tell you that housing in general, across the entire spectrum of the housing market, except for the ultra, ultra expensive, high price price houses and real estate, have been doing extremely well. Now, part of the reason may be that in some of these areas, you're seeing a resurgence of what we'll call manufactured housing. I mean, that doesn't mean mobile housing, all by the way. It means manufactured. These can be tilt-ups or put-togethers. You know, these don't necessarily have to be what you're thinking about, just, either trailers or mobiles. So I think that there is a need for a lot of housing, particularly as we have the millennials coming up through the system, making money, wanting to buy houses, first-time buyers, buying maybe lower-cost housing in certain areas around the country. And I think that they also have the opportunity to do a lot of leverage. And because of the fact that money is so cheap, the ability to leverage and in the creation of homes in particular, which are backed by the real estate and have other benefits like possibly yield on some of these, that they work out really well. Because we didn't get into the first stages of a recessionary period and housing is still doing really well. But as rates are coming down across the board, we're seeing that there's a real move. I mean, look at the big names. Look at Lennar's. Pulte. Look at any of the housing ETFs or indices or even the mutual funds. They're doing extraordinarily well this year. REITs are doing fantastic. So I think it's all about the lower rates. as we see that rates maybe will rise, we'll also see that those sectors will do well as people want to get in before the rates rise, which is why I've always thought that now lowering rates as things are doing so well in the U.S. is probably the stupidest thing they could have done. They should have just let it sit for a little while longer and had the idea that we may have rate increases in the future that would push money, push people into doing things. Because what they're doing is creating their own, the Fed is really creating their own deflationary process by saying we're going to probably reduce rates. That's not what you want to do, is talk about, hey, we're going to reduce prices. It doesn't get people off their keisters to do something. It holds them. Last question from James K. He says, hey, Andrew, really enjoy your two podcasts. My question is related to the recent WeWork IPO and best related to it. It has Goldman Sachs as an investor along with SoftBank and JP Morgan as an underwriter along with others. Pretty smart guys. How did they all miss all of your recent ideas on the economy? Wait. Oh, how did they all miss all out of the mispricing? It was $48 billion, now it's $8 billion. And what about all the other stocks they underwrite? Could we trust those? Also enjoy your recent ideas on the economy. Not sure how much longer we have in the cars, housing, college, public venture markets. Medical costs rising faster than wages, something that has to give. I fear for my kids now, 23 and 25. Keep up the great work, Jim. Hey, Jim, it's back to this overconfidence. It's back to the idea that we have this ball rolling downhill and it's going to keep on going no matter what. All we have to do is keep on pumping money into it. And as SoftBank kept on putting money into WeWork, creating their own pricing on the private side, most of these people were bamboozled because they thought they were able to do an IPO because the market's stupid. People are stupid. We'll push this off on the public. This is what they're saying. I'm not saying that. They'll push this off on the public, and then you know what happens? We'll recoup all our money. I don't think anybody thought there would be such a negative reaction to the financials when they came out, even though they were pretty disgusting. The overspending, overleveraging, and what was going on with the CEO, they should have known that, but they didn't care. Maybe 6 months ago, if this would have come out and the IPO would have gone through, everybody would have been made whole and everything would have been fine, except for the public, except for the people holding the bag that bought the IPO. But they don't care about that. I mean, the big boys and the bankers and the underwriters, they don't care about that. They used to, not anymore, because they figure, you know what? We'll keep on letting these IPOs go regardless of how good or bad they are as long as we can do it. And this obviously was a demarcation point that was, we've had enough. We've eaten as much crap as we can eat. We can't suck down another crappy IPO. It just so happened it was this one. Yes, the warning signs were there. It was very clear what was going on. It was, you know, all about really private equity, private businesses, venture capitalists, putting money in and developing their own pricing structure. It should have never been a $48 billion company. Who knows if it's really even worth $8 billion right now? Did they miss it? Did they miss the information, these smart guys? I don't think so. I think they knew exactly what was going on all along, but they figured, you know what? This guy is going to keep on pumping money in from SoftBank. We're not going to worry about it because we're going to push this IPO right through. It's going to be great. Everybody's made whole. We're out of the deal. Happy pappy. Just remember that these guys are not working in our interest. They're working in their own. While we can, at times, ride their coattails, just remember at the end of the day that they will come around and bite the hand that feeds them anytime they need to. So, thank you for your question. Hopefully that would give you an answer. Again, over at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Ask Andrew. Hey, we're going to end it right there. I think we had a pretty good information show. We have some guests coming up in the next few weeks. A lot of you have asked me, said, you know what, Andrew, I really appreciate all your insights. Seriously, I got a lot of emails like this that said, to the extent of, could you just cut the guests for a little while. I want to hear what's going on. It's a lot happening in the markets with the, you know, between tariffs and the political trends and what's going on around the world. And what are your insights? And if we can just spend a little more time discussing that. So that's what I've done over the last several weeks. We're going to get back to the guests. We have some good ones coming on. I think next week or the week after, Meb Faber will be our guest. We'll get Frank Curzio back very shortly. I want to thank you all for being here. Make sure to check out all of the different strategies. I would like you as a client, and I think you would like to be a client as well. I'll work directly with you. We'll get you set up right in the accounts and funds and strategies that you need to be in. Let's make it happen. Until next week, thanks so much. Have a profitable, a great week. And, you know, keep away from any of the investment banksters, okay? I'll see you then. Bye-bye. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as a sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training.